Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at plant diseases today a bit on the show. You know, we've had cold weather and then we've got warm weather this winter season and all those fluctuations in temperatures and in snowfall for that matter. What do they mean for our plants? We'll talk about that with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. And tell you what, he will talk about any kind of plant health issue and some other plant problems as well. So I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry.
Good to have you back. And we've got Garden Expo.
Yes,
you
indeed.
And I and Lisa Johnson.
2 weeks from today.
Yeah, 2 weeks from today. We're going to actually give away 5 pairs of tickets today. If a caller calls in and has a question and wants the tickets, you have to ask a question. If you ask a question and you want a pair of tickets, we'll make sure that you get a pair. Probably do it through will call. But Jill will get your name and phone number, and you know we'll get all the information that we need for that. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, indeed. I love Garden Expo. It's my favorite event the entire year.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's just a great, you know, in the winter, kind of you're about sick of winter. I love just going in, and it feels like spring in there. It smells great in there.
They always have a beautiful landscape in the middle that the Wisconsin Landscape Federation puts together, and it just they bring in mulch and everything that smells just wonderful.
And you are you and I and Lisa Johnson are talking on Saturday morning at 9:15.
Yes, or 9:30, somewhere around 9 o'clock.
Yeah,
yeah. So we're gonna do what I always call the live version of Garden Talk with Larry Mueller.
And you'll have some slides and photos and all that sort of thing.
And we'll be giving
away some books.
And we'll be goofy and talk about things that we love.
So that's coming up in a couple of weeks. But what about this weather that we've had in the this winter with the hot and kind of warm and cold and little snow and a lot of snow?
Yeah, I've been a little worried about both in terms of the temperature fluctuations and certainly here in the southern part of the state, a real lack of snow when we've had really pretty cold temperatures. With the heating and cooling, you can get heaving issues with plants. So if they're not well rooted and they freeze and thaw, then those plants can kind of be pushed out of the ground, which can be an issue. Once the roots are exposed, then if it gets cold again, those plants will probably die. The other thing I really worry about is a lack of snow cover. And when we get really cold temperatures without snow, snow is really insulating. And so if we have a good snow cover, we can keep our soil temperatures in probably the upper 20s typically. If we don't have snow cover and we get really cold temperatures, that soil temperature can drop down. And I remember 1 year, probably about a decade or more ago, where we had soil temperatures that were hovering in the high teens because of a lack of snow. And we had issues with a lot of trees, particularly fruit trees, having issues with cold damage on the root systems. So there's just physical cold damage on the roots, and then that inhibited water uptake the next spring, and there was a lot of branch dieback above ground.
Not a whole lot we can do right now about it.
Unfortunately, no. I mean, sometimes you can get some benefit if you kind of anticipate this happening by mulching a little bit more around the base of the trees to give a little added insulation, but that can be problematic in the spring. Oftentimes you need to remove that excess mulch to make sure it's away from the trunk. And if you have too much mulch, then you can retain too much water during the growing season, then you make the plants more prone to root rot issues.
Well, callers online, so let's take some calls. Dave and Chilton, we go to you first. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, I would mention, too, that we're all going to be down at the garden show, and I'm one of the farmers here in the state, one of the only farmers in the state, that's actually growing all the ancient grains, the farrow grains, such as einkorn, emmer, and spelt.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Do you have an exhibit?
Today, we're going to be doing a demonstration on both Saturday and Sunday, but not explaining to the people just how we grow the grains. I'm actually going to be working with a baker down there from Door County It's going to be telling the people, you know, hey, here's these grains. Here's how you folks can work with them and make bread in your home.
Wow. So that's going to be, so the people are going to have a chance to sort of take a bite out of some of those breads?
Oh, you betcha. We're going to bring some loaves of bread along as well.
Okay. So, and you're there the whole time, Dave?
Yeah, well, our booth will be there the whole time, but the demonstration we'll be doing on stage B on Saturday at 11:30, and then we'll be on stage A at 11:30 on Sunday and doing that same thing again.
Wow. Good luck, and it sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, it will be.
Thank you, Dave. So Dave Moyer of Moyer Farms, exhibiting on baking with Wisconsin-grown ancient grains at Garden Expo. That'll
Very
be a
cool.
lot of fun. Do we raise a lot of the ancient grains, do you know, offhand?
Certainly not on a commercial sort of setting. As far as I'm aware, we do grow, certainly grains that we grow are corn. We have some wheat, although it's not a large acreage compared to something like corn or soybeans.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks again, Dave. Let's go to Marilyn in Milwaukee. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I've got a question on hydrangea bush. It still has some dead blossoms. Do I leave them or crush them?
Yeah, you should be able to leave those and deal with them later on if you want to. I mean, you could certainly go and prune them off. What you have to be a little bit careful of is that you don't prune too much because a lot of times the plants have already formed buds over the winter. It depends on when the shrub bloomed, but if you cut back too much, you can actually remove blossoms for next year. In terms of if you want really specific information on how to go about generally cutting a hydrangea back, what I would do is within the next, let's see here, today's the 26th, within the next 5 days, you're in Milwaukee County, I see, give Sharon Morrissey a call.
Yeah.
Sharon is the horticulture educator in Milwaukee County. She's retiring at the end of the month, so take advantage of her while she's around, and she can give you specifics on exactly when and how to trim those shrubs.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much
for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, January 26th is Sharon Morrissey Day throughout Milwaukee County to recognize her for more than 25 years of service. Her last day with UW Extension Milwaukee County, January 31st. Maybe we'll hear from her today. We're trying to get a hold of her to have her call up and at least say hello and goodbye at the same time. I wanted to have a chance to wish her well and thank her for all her service to Wisconsin and certainly her appearances on this radio show. So, Sharon, if you're listening, call in. There you go. Dave in Madison up next. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I have a question about Japanese maples. Mm-hmm. I noticed that my Japanese maple didn't drop its leaves this fall like it normally does.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed on the tree, and they just turned brown and dried up. And I've noticed other Japanese maples that didn't drop their leaves. Now, normally, we get a cold day in the fall, and they all drop mm-hmm. in a couple of days. I'm wondering why this happened this year and if it's going to be a problem in the spring for them.
I doubt that it's going to be much of an issue. I would certainly watch the trees, though, and see whether you have any indication of dieback. Sometimes trees will not drop leaves if there's a particular... Oftentimes you want kind of a slow decline in temperatures so that the trees harden off for the winter, and then the leaves will form a little layer between the petiole, that's the little stem on the leaf, and the branch that allows the leaves to fall off. And if the temperatures change abruptly without enough time for that layer to form, then sometimes the trees will maintain their leaves. So that may be what has gone on. Definitely, I would watch the trees. Excuse me for a second here. definitely watch the tree. I would be a little bit worried if, you know, the temperatures were relatively warm and then it really precipitously dropped and got really cold. Those types of maples, the really ornamental Japanese and Korean maples, tend to be a little bit cold sensitive. And so you might get some physical injury from a severe and rapid drop in temperature. So I would just watch that in the spring. You may have to do some judicious pruning back if there's some branch dieback. But again, we do see retention retention of leaves on other types of maples on occasion. We see it on oaks on occasion. And oftentimes it's not an indication of a problem. And the as the new buds form in the spring, oftentimes they'll just push those old leaves off.
Oh, they will. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it shouldn't be a problem.
It's 10 years, and it's never held on to its leaves before.
Yeah, again, my thought is that it was just you may have had a sort of weird temperature pattern as the trees were going dormant. So just watch it. If you have any issues with that, you're welcome to take some photos. You can email me photos, and I'll give out my email address here. It's pddc@wisc.edu. And you're welcome to send me photos. And oftentimes I can't tell exactly what's wrong based on a photo, but I'm happy to take a look at those photos and kind of give you a best guess.
Okay.
And if I think there's a more serious problem, we might have to negotiate about you sending in a sample. We do charge for that, unfortunately. But
For
the samples if they come in. But I'm happy to look at photos free of charge.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Dave. Jacob in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Jacob.
So I'm closing on my first house March 30th. It's 3 acres, and it's got a number of apple trees on mm-hmm. it, Honeycrisp specifically, and they're all at different stages. And I'm just wondering, apple tree 101, what am I looking for? What am I doing? How do I keep them healthy?
Yeah, what I would suggest that you do is there's a wonderful publication on the Learning Store website. This is the UW Extension Publications website, and it's learningstore, all one word, .uwex.edu. And if you type in apple in the search line, and then when it pops up all the publications, there's this wonderful publication called Growing Apples in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
and
it's a good one.
It's a great publication. It basically walks you through all the process of selecting varieties and how to plant and how to prune and everything you need to know about growing apples here in the state. And I would get a copy of that. It's a great publication actually to order a hard copy. A lot of those publications you can just view online, but this is one that I oftentimes recommend that people actually buy because it's such a wonderful publication. And if you're growing other types of fruit trees or other fruit crops like peaches or cherries or anything of that sort or raspberries, there are equivalent publications for those particular types of fruit crops as well. And so I think that's a good starting point. And you're here in, where are you located again?
Eau Claire.
In Eau Claire. Then if you have additional questions, I would call Erin LaFave at the Eau Claire County Extension Office.
Yeah.
And she's the horticulture educator up in that area.
That's a good job.
She should be able to answer additional questions if you have them. Now, in terms of disease problems on apples, probably the big one that we see is apple scab. And I'd have to go back to see if Honeycrisp is resistant or not. Some varieties have been bred for resistance. But sometimes that disease can be an issue and can cause a lot of defoliation. It's probably the biggest problem I see on most apple varieties. The other disease that I would watch for, if you get a lot of kind of branch dieback, there's a bacterial disease called fire blight, which can be an issue as well. You have to be really proactive about that particular disease and watch for it and do pruning if you see branch dieback. But if you see anything of that sort and want to send me photos or want to contact me once you start to see symptoms, I'm happy to talk to you on the phone or via email. And I can give out my phone number too, 608-262-2863. I do this all the time, so don't be bashful about calling or emailing.
Super. Right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're quite welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, visiting today with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW. Great to have him along. And you know what, Brian? Sharon Morrissey is on the phone. Sharon!
Hello, everybody.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Winding down here.
Oh, my goodness me. I didn't know that you were retiring, and it's been, what, 25 years in Milwaukee County?
Yeah, a little over 25 years, almost 26. So, but, you know, there are so many people who are in extension who were in extension when I arrived that are still working. Makes me feel like kind of a slouch, you know, a little bit.
Well, I think it's wonderful that the whole of Milwaukee County is Sharon Morrissey Day today.
I can't believe the news traveled so far. I'm so honored.
Well,
it's been a great career. UW Extension is just an institution that I believe in so wholeheartedly. We have so many good things to offer, and that knowledge that we have, the science-based information that we're giving people, just gives you the confidence that you really are giving people good advice that'll really help them. And helping people and talking about plants, you know, how can you go wrong?
How can you go wrong with that? And now, do you have some retirement plans?
Not big plans. I plan to, I have plans. I'm going to read books. I'm going to work in my garden. I'm going to go to Goodwill, I have to say. That's sort of my weak spot.
Uh-huh.
And things like that. I'm going to do a little bit of traveling and, just learn what life is like without the stress of a full-time job and being able to do the stuff I love.
Well, I tell you what, you have been a wonderful representative of UW Extension. Certainly, I have enjoyed working with you on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you're going to be sorely missed. But, good luck.
Thank you very much. I'm really grateful for all the opportunities that I've had and to have people let me know that they appreciate my work. I mean, not everybody gets that in their job, and I am just so lucky to have all of that and all of my colleagues at the UW and in UW Extension. So thank you very much for your well wishes. And I sensed that you were talking about. I can hear you. No, it's a little birdie, actually.
Well, I just got done saying a few minutes back, if Sharon's listening, I hope she calls in because I want to talk to her and wish her well.
I have spies. I have listeners. So, well, thank you very much.
Sharon, thank you, and good luck in retirement.
Best of luck, Sharon.
Sharon Morrissey, 25 years, or more than 20, almost 26 years in Milwaukee County. She's been the consumer horticulture agent. And on January 31st, she steps down from her UW Extension position. Sad day for a lot of us, happy day for her. And we're certainly happy that she has good health and wishing her well. Sharon Morrissey. Well, we have more callers online here, Brian. So I'm going to go back to the phones and to Heather in Neshkoro. Hi, Heather.
Hello. I have a question about bridal wreaths. They're probably 20, 25-year-old plants. A lot of woody, dead branches. Can I prune those at this time of year without completely affecting the blooms in a bad way come this spring?
Yeah, at this point, the blooms will have already formed for the spring. So if you do a lot of aggressive pruning on those shrubs, you will take out the flowers and you won't get any blossoms this spring. So I'd be a little bit cautious. And again, I'm not the best person to ask about exactly how to prune these sorts of plants. That's not my area of expertise. So if you need details on how to do it, I would contact, which county are you in?
Washera.
Oh, Washera County. You could certainly contact the county extension office there. I'm trying to think who's in Washera County.
I'm blanking now, too.
Yeah, I'm blanking now as well. So in any event, I would start there, and then they can contact some of our horticultural experts down here in Madison if you need lots of details on how to prune them. So,
All right.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
But you do have to be careful with a lot of these trees and shrubs because particularly if they bloom early in the spring, they've already set flower buds for the following year by the time we get into the winter. And so if you prune them out really severely, you can basically totally eliminate any bloom the following year.
Mary in Butternut, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I got a question.
Okay.
I had read somewhere that you could take you could regrow beet greens by just cutting like a half inch off the top of the beet. So I thought, I love beet greens. So I figured I'm going to do that. So I did it. they started growing beautifully, and now they've got what looks like bug eggs all over them.
What did you do? You took the beet greens and put them in water then?
Nope, planted them in dirt.
Yeah, so they probably rooted from just that little bit of the top of the root system that you had. So
there was half an inch of the top of the beet, too.
Yeah, and so they rooted well for you. That's really cool that you can actually do that. I've never considered doing that before, but I may try that sometime.
I read a lot, so I find out all this stuff, and I like fresh food.
Well, that's part of the reason I love doing this show, because I learn all kinds of stuff when I come on here. So thank you for that. In terms of what may be going on with the bumps on the leaves, are they on the undersurface, upper surface?
They're all over.
All over.
I notice, you know, I've got all kinds of house plants, and I've got some onions growing too.
Okay.
The onions are doing fine. There's nothing on them. There's nothing on my house plants.
Okay.
Just on the beets.
Yeah. Is there a lot of growth distortion in those leaves that have the bumps? Do they look kind of wrinkled and?
No, they look okay.
They look okay.
They got the bumps on them, and
Do those rub off?
Like bug eggs.
Do they rub off at all? Can you detach them?
I haven't actually tried to see if they would.
Yeah. If they were truly insect eggs, I would expect you to be able to remove them from the leaves. One of the things I'm a little bit suspicious about might be something called edema. And this is something that happens to the plants. If you're watering quite a bit and it's relatively humid, they take up a lot of water. It gets to the leaves, and then they don't lose a lot of water through the leaves. And so the leaves get overhydrated. And the way that the plants deal with this is they kind of push out a bunch of cells onto the surface of the leaf, and you get these little masses of cells. Oftentimes, those are on the undersurface, but I've seen them on the upper surface of the leaves as well. So that may be what you're doing or what's happening for you. What you might want to do is cut back a little bit on the water.
Okay, I don't water. You know, I wait until the dirt starts to look a little dry.
Okay.
And my house is on the dry side.
Okay.
So I just, everybody in my house gets watered max once a week.
Okay.
Sometimes less. Sometimes I forget.
Sure. Do you have a digital camera by any chance?
No, I don't.
Okay. I'm just trying to think if there's a way for you to get some photos to me, because it would be really interesting to see this. But my best guess, based on your description and by the fact that you're not having problems on other plants, might be this edema problem.
I tried the dish soap and water, and I did that on them.
Sure.
And doesn't look like it did anything.
Yeah, and again, that makes me think that it's probably something going on with the actual plant. So I'm trying to think of a way. What you could do, where's butternut? That's a ton.
Northern Wisconsin.
In Ashland County.
Oh, in Ashland County.
Right on the southern end.
Yeah, then what I would do would be see if you can get up to the county office and take some of those leaves up there and drop them off for probably Matt Cogger would be the person that you'd want to talk with up there who does horticulture. And
I don't know how to find my way up there. Usually what I do is I go to the extension office in Phillips.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you could do that as well. And then they could, I'm sure they have a digital camera that they could use to take some photos, and then tell them to send some photos down to Brian and also PJ Leash, who's our insect person. And we can both take a look at those and see whether we can get some information back to you about exactly what's going on. But I'm a little doubtful that it's an actual insect problem. It could be. But I think based on what you're describing, I'm thinking my first thought again goes
edema.
To this edema problem.
Yeah.
It's very common in the wintertime.
They're still edible.
If that's the case, then they still should be edible, although it might change the flavor a little bit. So what you might want to do is, you know, taste a few of them and see if they taste okay, and then if they don't, you know, try again.
Yeah.
Cut them back and then allow them to resprout maybe a little bit.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Julie emailed, by the way, to say that the Fox River Valley Chapter of Wild Ones is hosting its annual Toward Harmony with Nature conference. It's Saturday at the Oshkosh Convention Center, and Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery is the keynote speaker.
And Lisa Johnson will also be up there giving a talk. So.
Oh, there we go. So that's the Wild Ones chapter of Fox River Valley, the annual Toward Harmony with Nature conference at the Oshkosh Convention Center. Let's go to Edie in Heartland next. Hi, Edie. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I've called you guys before, and I've gotten a lot of help. I brought in four potted hibiscus when the weather finally got bad. They were still blooming outside and everything. And one is getting to live upstairs, and it's doing beautiful. It's even blooming. The other three are in the basement. Two are the double flowers with the thin leaves. One is like a single, the old-fashioned hibiscus with the thick leaves. That one's got black spots all over the leaves.
Okay.
Is that going to transfer to the other ones, or what's
it could
on?
Potentially, if it is a fungal disease. How much light are they getting? Are they, you got plenty of light for them?
No, they're not getting much at all. What they're getting is a fluorescent above them. That's it.
Yeah, some of it could actually be a light-related phenomenon. How discreet are the spots? Are they really circular, or is it kind of blotchy areas that are?
They look pretty circular to me.
Okay. It could be. There are certainly diseases that I see on hibiscus. There's a bacterial disease that we see. If you've got that, there's not going to be much you're going to be able to do about that. There are some fungal leaf spots, and I would tend to kind of isolate that plant from your other plants just to limit possible exposure of your healthier-looking plants.
Yeah, I thought maybe it wouldn't transfer because the leaves are so different. You know, I'm talking about the two different kinds of leaves on a hibiscus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like a palm, and the other one is very light and airy type of thing.
Yeah. But I would worry that there might be some ability of the if it is a fungus or bacterium, of infecting those other hibiscus plants. So I would tend to keep them as far apart as you possibly can. Just
what would
to be
an ideal distance apart?
It's always hard to say with these things. Oftentimes in indoor settings, it's relatively dry. So if it's a fungal pathogen, they don't produce a lot of spores under that sort of those sorts of conditions. Mm. So you don't have a lot of spore production that can blow to the plants. But my adage is usually as far apart as you possibly can get them. Farther is better. If it can only be a few inches, that's better than them being right up next to one another and the leaves rubbing and touching.
All right.
But I appreciate it. So it could be contagious. That was my main
It's concern. Possible that it could be. It may not be. It's always hard to tell when people describe things exactly what it is, but it sounds like it could be either a bacterial or a fungal disease, in which case it could be contagious. Yes.
They've been down there for 3 months now, though, to have it start all of a sudden. What's throwing you?
Yeah, sometimes we see long delays in symptom development. It's really kind of interesting. Some of the bacteria in particular will live on the surface of the plant, and even though they're disease-causing organisms, you don't see any symptoms. And then there's some environmental trigger that makes them grow like crazy, and then all of a sudden the spots form. So that's not unusual.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. And more callers online. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Do you have some indoor plants that seem to be having trouble coping? Maybe some disease problems, something thriving in those plants that shouldn't be there? Join in. Among other things, Brian can talk about tree diseases and pretty much the whole gamut. So, let's go to Mark in Mequon. Hi, Mark.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my 200-year-old oak tree behind my house. Last year, we need to prune it because there's some areas that need to be cut back. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to prune it between November and March. But last year, with the warm weather, we were advised not to because of the unusually warm February.
Good advice.
And so I was wondering what about this year? If we should still, if we're okay to go ahead doing it now, or should we hold off?
Yeah, are you pruning it yourself, or are you having a professional come in and do it for you?
I'm going to have a professional come in and do it, but I want to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you could get them, they probably are busy and probably are booked, but if you could get them to come out like right now, this has been great weather for doing pruning, and we oftentimes recommend winter pruning on most trees, and particularly oaks.
Yeah.
So this period where it's just a little bit warmer, but we haven't had a long stretch of warmth, would be a great time to come out and do some pruning on the tree. Now, if it gets to the point where it has to be pruned and it's warmer and it's been warm for a while, what we worry about are certain insects, sap beetles in particular, that can move in the oak wilt fungus. If it gets to the point where you just desperately have to have the tree pruned and it has to be done when it's actively growing and it's warm out, then make sure that whoever you contract with paints over those pruning wounds immediately after making the cut on the tree. They can use a pruning paint. They can use old latex paint left over from you painting your home. You just need to put some sort of physical barrier over those cuts. Better to do it when it's a little colder, when the insects aren't active. But sometimes you have to prune when it's warm, and then in that case, you need to put that paint barrier over the wound.
And by immediately, I
mean immediately. Like
there's been some research on this where
about 10 minutes, can potentially have sap beetles visit a cut wound on an oak tree. So if you wait a half an hour, it may be too late.
Okay. Now, should we go ahead and do the painting even if they cut it now, if it runs, stays in the 40s, 30s, and 40s in our area?
Yeah, I usually err on the side of caution because of oak wilt. That's a lethal disease. If you get that in your oaks, then they are basically going to die.
Right. So, yeah, that's why we're being so careful.
Yeah, my suggestion would be to just err on the side and go ahead and paint over the wounds. If it was a warm day and then all of a sudden we're going to have a cold stretch, then I wouldn't worry. But if it looks like the forecast is for an extended period, you have to really worry about it, whether it stays warm enough, long enough for the sap beetles to be active. And at this time of the year, I wouldn't expect that to happen.
Right.
But as we get into later February into March, oftentimes we're getting warmer and warmer springs and late winters. Then I worry a little bit more about that.
All right, great. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're having suddenly having some technical problems with our phone line. No, not with our phone line. Some other technical problems that we are working on resolving. I guess we don't have problems with the phone. So Jill says, no, we're not having problems with the phone. So you can call in with your own questions or comments on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Brian Huddleston. Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. On this edition of Garden Talk, we're visiting with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. What's happening in plants and plant diseases in the wintertime? That's kind of what we're talking about with him, and taking a few other questions as well. Larry Mueller here. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Apparently, Jill was telling me there's a high-pitched tone that some people are hearing on the radio, and we are working on that. It's not your own radio. It's something... a problem that we're having. Ron in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hello.
Just sorry to let you know, that tone cleared up. I don't hear it anymore.
Oh, good.
You're one of the recipients of the tone.
Okay, thank you. What's on your mind?
Yeah, we got a maple tree that my father planted in the mid-1950s. It's about 63 years ago he planted it as a sapling. And in the past few summers, it's been dropping leaves in the summer when they're still green. And I was just wondering, I know I've had to have it trimmed because the local power company and utilities had it trimmed because they have utility right away. But they sheared it off pretty much on East Face. But I was just wondering, this problem dropping green leaves in the summer, what could be the cause of that?
Yeah, they're totally green, no browning, no spotting. They look totally healthy?
Yes.
Yes, okay. One of the things I would think of when somebody talks to me about that, there is a little, I believe it's a petiole borer on maples that can cause problems. So what I would check on those leaves is see whether the little stems on the leaves look shorter than normal. Mm-hmm. And if they do, it could be this little insect. How much defoliation are you seeing on the tree?
Well, it's not that big, but it's kind of, sporadic, scattered around.
Yeah.
Say stems, are you talking about the stem within the leaf or the twig that the leaf
is attached? No, the actual little stem part on the leaf, that's called the petiole, and there's an insect that actually chops that off, and then the leaves will fall off. So
leaves that fall on the ground when they're green, they're whole. They don't look like...
Yep. Yeah.
Yes, and again, just check that little stem and compare it, the little petiole, and compare it to leaves that are still attached to the tree and see if it's shorter or not.
And one other thing people have been seeing is squirrels.
Yes, that occurs on occasion as well. Oftentimes you get clusters, though. They'll go after the small branches, and you'll get a clump of leaves that'll fall to the ground.
Yeah, not the single leaf.
Not
You're
the
right.
single leaves.
Yep.
But I would certainly watch for that. If it's a small number of leaves, I wouldn't be overly concerned. Trees seem to be very resilient to losing a few leaves here or there. So I don't think it's a serious long-term issue with the tree.
All right. Thank you so much, Ron, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Ed in Dodgeville next. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing? My question is about my asparagus patch that seems to be getting smaller and smaller every year. Huh. And this is the first year I have had no berries on my asparagus.
Okay. Yeah, how long have you had the patch in the ground?
14 years.
Okay. What you may be getting is a buildup. There are certain soil-borne pathogens that can adversely affect asparagus. There's a fungus called Fusarium that will cause both a kind of a root and crown rot, and also sometimes can get inside the plant and colonize the water-conducting tissue and block it off, and that'll cause a gradual decline in the plants. Unfortunately, there's not much you can do for that once...
Can't do a fungicide at all.
No, unfortunately, no. And my suggestion would be to try to find another spot in your yard where you can grow asparagus and establish a new patch and buy
How
new
far
plants.
Away?
Again, it's one of those things, the farther is better.
Further is better.
Yeah, further is better. It's always hard to
right
say.
In town, that's why I'm asking. I mean, basically, my whole backyard
okay.
is my garden.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I would
I
say.
I live in town, and it's like, man, and my wife and I, we just love the asparagus.
Sure. So if you can move it as far away as you possibly can, that would be my suggestion. If it's 2 feet, 4 feet versus 2 feet, do the 4 feet.
Okay.
Just get it as far away from those plants as you possibly can. The other thing
now,
that
if I remove the plants for a number of years, will that pathogen go away, or is that a, or will it stay in the ground and I'm just done?
It depends on the particular organism that you're dealing with. The one that gets kind of into the water conducting tissue and blocks it off, oftentimes that one is pretty specific to asparagus.
Okay.
Although there are other variants of that fungus that will go to other types of vegetable crops, but there's just a specific one variant of that organism that goes to asparagus that I would expect to decline over time. Now,
okay.
if some of the root and crown rot organisms, if it's something like Phytophthora or Pythium, those can last for a long, long time. They produce resting spores with some of the species of Phytophthora. Resting spores can survive for 40 years or more, so we're talking long term.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of bad news when you get those, but I'm guessing it's more likely this Fusarium. If you really want to know for certain, if you want to take one of those plants and send it into my lab, we can test for you and kind of tell you exactly what you're dealing
I'll do
with.
It.
And the charge would be on the order of probably $25 to $30 to process the sample.
That's worth it. Yeah, that's worth it for us because it, you know.
Then you have a better idea.
We're saving money by
sure.
it as opposed to buying it.
Yeah, the other thing that we'll watch for if you send in a sample, because the other thing could be some sort of boring insect in the crown.
Oh,
so
yeah,
definitely
really?
we want to check for that as well. So that's what's
well,
always.
If I pulled the crown up, I'd be able to tell if there was.
Yes, you'd probably see trails, and it could be a combination of both as well. So it may be that the insects get in, do some damage, but open up wounds, and that allows the pathogens to get in.
Okay. All right, I'll do that. I'll send in. Can I get tickets for the garden show?
I don't know. Are we out of tickets? Well, we have one set. Yes, we hang
right,
on there.
Out.
We'll put you on
right.
hold, Ed.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for all the vital information. I really appreciate it, and then I'll send a crown in.
You're
all
quite
right.
welcome.
Thanks very much. And I think, Jill, have you got, let's see, let me lock him in. I think Jill's got him locked in. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. All this talk about pathogens, how the heck do they survive the winter?
They do quite well. Some of them, if they're foliar pathogens, so ones that go into leaves, oftentimes they're associated with old leaf debris. And so one of the things we really encourage folks to do is good cleanup to get rid of that old plant material.
Yeah.
And then you can either burn it if you want to try that. Again, not really environmentally friendly, but that's a great option, actually. Sometimes you can bury it to get it underground. And then some of these leaf pathogens, you can compost the material, and that's a perfectly good way of getting rid of those. The heat and the decay of the plant tissue will eliminate the pathogen. Others of them will produce certain types of structures that survive long-term in the soil. So those are more difficult to manage. I've mentioned this Phytophthora that has what's called an oospore, and that can survive for a long time. There are other examples of similar sorts of things. It really depends on the particular organism.
You know, I don't think we've heard about evergreens yet.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen, how are they faring this year?
I have not seen, had a lot of things come in. One of the things I might worry a little bit might be some winter burns. So if folks did not water their evergreens, particularly yews, really well as we got into the fall, sometimes they can dehydrate over the wintertime. If you're in an area where there's a lot of wind, sometimes that will dehydrate them as well, make winter burn even worse. And definitely I would watch for that. And where I usually see that are on yews and like Alberta spruce, oftentimes gets a lot of burn problems. We have a very nice winter burn fact sheet that's available. Oh. Laura Joel wrote that several years ago. If you go to my clinic website, again, pddc.wisc.edu, you go to the fact sheet section and all of our one-page University of Wisconsin garden facts are available there. And just look down under W for winter burn and you should be able to find it.
Excellent. Well, Bill in Kewaunee has a question for you. Let's go there. Bill, hello. Thank you for calling. Did I lose Bill? Maybe Bill's
on. I have some... Hello?
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
You're on now.
Hi. Yes. I bought a house a few years back, and I have some 15-year-old, I'm guessing, apple trees.
Okay.
Now, I'm from the city. I know nothing about pruning them. I've looked in the books... And the real question is there anywhere I can call to get someone to come out, prune these trees, and train me how to prune them?
Yeah, in terms of calling someone with extension, they might or might not come out at least to do a consultation and show you something. That really varies from county to county, and I don't know what the policy is in Kewaunee County. But you could call the county extension office there and see whether they do site visits. They might refer you to some sort of private company that would do that sort of thing. The other thing I would ask about through the extension office is whether there are workshops that are offered anywhere in your area. Lots of times counties will run pruning workshops, and I don't know if they would do that in Kewaunee County, but you're close enough maybe to Sheboygan County or Brown County where they might have some pruning workshops there that you could tap into. So I would definitely go through the Kewaunee County office and start there, and then they can give you additional resources on that. Again, I mentioned earlier this publication called Growing Apples in Wisconsin that's available at our Learning Store website, and that would be a publication that you might want to take a look at online if you're hooked up to the internet, because that's got a lot of information on just growing apples and pruning and a variety of other aspects of apple production.
I bought the extension guide to growing apples.
Yep.
But these trees are much bigger and a lot more complicated.
Yep.
In those directions.
Yeah. So
but thank you very much.
Yeah. That may be a situation where you'll want to contract with a professional in your area to come and do the pruning for you. So.
And the Kewaunee County Extension Office would probably have names of
folks in your area that could do that for you. The other thing you could do would be to go to the just do a search on the Wisconsin Arborist Association and see whether there's someone. They have a searchable website where you can put in your county, and then they'll give you a list of certified arborists that can help you out with things like pruning. Now, again, you'd probably want to talk specifically with any of the arborists on that list about whether they typically prune fruit trees, because sometimes that's a little bit different than pruning ornamental trees. So definitely those folks are great folks to tap into, but just make sure that they feel comfortable pruning a fruit tree.
All right.
Well, that's great, because we just retired here. Now I'll be able to stick with it.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Bill.
Once and go. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Yeah. Let's go to another Bill. This one in Oregon. Bill, hello.
I have another pruning question. I'm going to be pruning some white pines this winter because they're starting to push over the road, and I'm just trying to avoid any, trying to avoid any diseases or any other impacts on the tree, or as little impacts as I can.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of I mean, I've seen things about putting things over over the cuts on pines and other recommendations to not do so.
Yeah, the only time we really typically recommend using any sort of pruning paint or paint on wounds when you're pruning trees would be for oaks, if you have to prune those, particularly during the growing season when it's relatively warm. Normally, for most other trees, we do not recommend pruning paints or any sort of coat, no matter when you're doing that. But I think winter is a good time to prune in general. You're less likely to have disease problems. What we find, what the research tends to show, is that if you use pruning paints all the time, it tends to slow down the normal process where the plants produce tissue to cover over that cut surface. And so it's better off normally to do the pruning and not add the paint. Things to keep in mind, though, when you are pruning is don't do it when it's wet. Make sure you have several days where it looks like it's going to be dry before you do the pruning. And again, I would recommend that you do it in the wintertime in general for most situations, for most trees. There are some exceptions, but in general rule of thumb is winter pruning tends to be a good time to do the pruning.
Any specifics for a white pine?
No, that would be one where you could do the pruning right now. It's okay. Nice and warm at this point. You're planning on taking off larger branches, is that correct?
Well, there's a few larger branches that are low on the lower end that are starting to push over the road.
Yeah, and you'll want to prune those relatively close to the main trunk. What I would suggest that you do is, are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes.
Yeah, go to my clinic website, pddc.wisc.edu. Go into our fact sheet series and just do a search on pruning. We have three fact sheets. And there is one on pruning evergreens, but for the type of pruning that you really need to do, I would use the other one, which is how to properly prune, what's it called, deciduous trees.
Okay.
Because that talks about a three-cut method for pruning off larger branches to prevent you from stripping off the bark on lower down on the tree. If you don't prune them properly, sometimes the branches will just kind of come off and it'll strip bark down the trunk, which you don't want to do. So that'll talk about this three-cut method, and that's a great way to do the pruning to prevent that from happening.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Thinking about houseplants for a minute, what are the common houseplant diseases that we're seeing that we normally see?
Not a lot of diseases on houseplants, per se. What I see more of would be like fluoride injury from people using tap water to water plants. So some of the plants, particularly things like spider plants, can be a little bit sensitive to fluoride. I was reading a little bit on, oftentimes we talk about chlorine as well, but from the reading I've done, that doesn't seem to be as much of a concern as the fluoride. And so to avoid that, it's just use either somehow filter your water or buy distilled water, deionized water to use. And then just make sure that you fertilize on a regular basis, specific for that particular type of houseplant. Because part of the reason to use tap water is there are some minerals in there that the plants can use. And if you start using deionized water, distilled water, those
then
sorts of minerals
to,
aren't there.
To throw a little fertilizer.
Fertilizer on, yeah.
I have always used tap water for limey, my lime tree, mm-hmm. and seems to do well. Limey sits outside all winter,
sure.
all summer, but
yeah, and it really depends on the particular plant. Some plants are much more sensitive to these additions to the water than others. So,
Brett emailed to say he has a large black walnut with a large branch that's broken and hanging, and it's about 50 feet up. Is it important to remove that for the health of the tree?
I would be more worried about if it's a really large branch. If you don't prune it off, it eventually coming off on its own. And if someone that's important in your life is standing beneath it, they might get hit by it. So it's a hazard rather than a disease issue. If it's broken and it doesn't look like there's any sort of infection in the branch, it's just a broken branch, probably not a big problem from a disease standpoint. If you're going to, since it's so far up, if you do want to have that pruned off, you're probably going to have a professional come in and do it for you. So, and if there is any sort of infection, it's probably already occurred. So it's one of these situations where I tend to say, yeah, go ahead and prune it off, but probably it may not make that much of a difference. Depends on whether anything just happened to get in at the time of breakage.
And if it's 50 feet in the air, probably get somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, certified arborist, definitely. And again, we talked about doing a search online for the Wisconsin Arborist Association, and they have a searchable database.
Are there arborists? Some. I'm trying to remember. I think there are arborists that attend Garden Expo. Are there not?
They have in the past had a booth. I don't know whether recently they have. I can check while we're on break and see what I can find, whether they're going to have a booth there this year or not.
Are they? And let's talk about Garden Talk for just a minute. I'm sorry, Garden Expo mm-hmm. for just a minute, because there may be people listening who aren't familiar with it. So talk about what it is.
It's a huge, basically, garden show, and there's a huge hall with lots and lots of vendors, both people who are selling stuff and a lot of educational booths. So, for example, I have two booths on plant diseases. You can come and talk to me about your plant disease problems. There are folks from a variety of the different societies, so Hardy Plant Society, Daylily Society, those sorts of folks who are there that are giving out information. UW Extension, I'm certainly part of that, but there'll be a large UW Extension area where you can ask general horticulture questions. And then there are a lot of programs, a lot of talks, seminars, demonstrations, very educational. It's 2.5 days or so. And if you can, come down for the entire 2.5 days, because there are different things every day.
There are different things every day, and the number of talks is
absolutely phenomenal.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You could spend all day, and of course, you and I and Lisa Johnson, just to remind, are going to be presenting on Saturday morning at, I think, 9:15, and in one of the places. They're always easy to find, pretty easy to find. And then you have another presentation on vegetable diseases.
Right. I'm doing that twice. I think I'm doing it once Friday afternoon late. I can't remember the exact time. And then another one on Saturday in the afternoon, I believe.
Brian Huddleston, our guest. Brian is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, and, of course, also works with UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, with the UW Extension as well. And he's answering your questions about plant disease today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page as well. If you got a garden photo or plant photo that you want to put up on our Facebook page, that would be great. And we don't always go outside the country, or often, but we're going to go to Costa Rica right now. Connie Beam is with us. Connie is the WPR Senior Advisor for Planned Giving. Connie, are you there? Oh, let's see. Well, did we lose her? Well, maybe we lost her. Wisconsin Public Radio has a tour going on in Costa Rica. And, well, let's try again. Connie, are you there?
I'm here, Larry.
Oh, there, we got you now. Yeah, we got you now. So tell our listeners what's going on. What are you guys up to? You're on a tour of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, right?
We've been down in Costa Rica now for several days, and our group is about 31 people, and we started out in San Jose, and we visited several different kinds of tropical forests, starting out with the cloud forest in Monteverde, and that was extremely interesting, all the different kinds of plants that grow there.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And we moved. When we were walking around in the cloud forest, it was mostly raining on us, and you're walking through the clouds. So it's amazing. And now we've gone north and a little further west, and now we're in a dry tropical forest, which is completely different from where we were up in the wet cloud forest. Very, very interesting.
Oh, and so how long are you going to be there for now?
We'll be here until next Tuesday, and then, but I did want to tell you quickly about some of the plants that our guides have been telling us about. The first one they told us about was the tourist tree, and they call it that because it turns red and peels.
I love it. The tourist tree turns red and peels.
The bark of the trunk just completely peels off, and it's its way of surviving so that the strangle fig doesn't grow up on it and strangle it to death. So anyway, it's very interesting.
Well, it sounds like you're having a good time.
We are, and it's really fun because we've seen a lot of birds that we see at home, but then they come down here to winter. And so we've seen some kingfishers and some tanagers and hummingbirds galore. It really is a wonderful, wonderful place.
Oh, it sounds like a wonderful Wisconsin Public Radio trip. Thank you very much, Connie, for calling in all the way from Costa Rica.
All right. Well, thanks for taking my call. And, Brian, I hope you get everybody's questions answered today.
Thank you very much. We'll try.
All right. Thanks, Connie.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. Appreciate that call. So there they are in Costa Rica. And I've gone on a couple of WPR tours. We did a garden tour in England several years back, and we did another tour I was on with WPR listeners in Hawaii.
Very cool.
Which I really enjoyed a lot. And those tours, the people on those tours, well, they're all public radio people.
Sure.
So
sure.
They're a lot of fun to be around.
Well, I think you should do one to New Zealand and Australia. I just visited there in November and December, and that was certainly a wonderful experience.
Did you have a chance to see some new plants and so forth?
Actually, it was interesting how many plants I actually recognized. And again, it makes kind of sense because a lot of the plants, both being colonized by the British, a lot of the same plants came here to North America and also down there. But what shocked me, they were in their late spring down there, so everything was pretty much in full bloom. But the major weed along the roads in New Zealand as we were driving were lupins. They were acres and acres and acres of lupins along the roadways. It was absolutely amazing. And foxgloves that had naturalized out along the roads. It was really very cool.
Very interesting. Well, maybe we can talk some more about that, but we've got Mary in Madison with a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I have one quick question about putting bark mulch around trees when it comes to that time in April or so. Last year at the garden show, you recommended against that. Is that still the case?
Municipal mulches, yeah.
Yeah.
I still don't recommend that. The primary problem is that many of our street trees are ashes and maples, and one of the things that could be killing them off and be the reason for the removal is a disease called verticillium wilt. It's a fungal disease, and mm-hmm. that particular disease, the pathogen has a very wide host range, and you can potentially introduce that pathogen into a landscape in contaminated mulch. So I really recommend staying away. I hate saying that because it's a great way to recycle these trees is to chip them up, but we have some pretty good evidence that it potentially could be a problem. And not only to other trees, but also if you grow vegetables, the pathogen will go to a lot of our very common and favorite vegetable crops.
Well, when I go to the garden store, I mean, the stuff in the sacks, they say is okay.
Right.
And it should be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I normally recommend, if you need a lot of mulch, you can get bulk mulch. What I normally recommend in that case would be something like shredded oak bark mulch. I think that's mm-hmm. a good, sturdy mulch. Personally, when I go, I usually buy the bags like you're talking about, and I usually go for red cedar mulch
mm-hmm.
because that's one that I think smells good. It lasts quite a while. You don't necessarily have to apply it every year. And it doesn't seem to be a real serious problem in terms of bringing in pathogens.
That's what I use as well.
Mm-hmm.
Red cedar?
Yeah, red cedar.
And do you think there'd be a problem with pathogens if I get something else?
Probably not. I would definitely, though, read the bag, see what's inside, what material's in there. Lots of times those bag materials are of only one particular kind of tree, or at least supposedly based on the labeling on the bag. Those I would worry a little bit less about than this mulch that you might be getting that you don't know exactly what the composition is of the mulch.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, and for the city, would there be some way that they could be heating up their mulch so that this is not a problem?
I would love to have a graduate student that comes in and does that as a research project, because that's an obvious extension of this other work. I had a graduate student who looked at verticillium, and she's the one that kind of documented that you can find it in these chipped up trees and that it will last for a fairly long time in the environment. And she also demonstrated that if you use the chips in certain ways, that you can infect plants with the pathogen. So that's why we don't recommend it. And the logical follow-up would be to develop some sort of composting strategy to compost the material so it would be useful. She did a little mini experiment, and unfortunately, under the conditions that she used, it wasn't a long enough composting. She actually got better recovery of the pathogen after composting than before. So it's, I think, a matter of the right length of time, the right temperature, but we just don't know the parameters. We don't know what to tell you to do exactly to decontaminate that material. Again, that's why I would love to have a student who kind
of that's a great idea. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. You know, kind of reminded me that last conversation about cleanup and and fall cleanup. And I know there are a lot of people who probably didn't get that done.
Yeah, that happens all the time. I'm guilty of that as well. And my recommendation is simply to get out early in the spring after things have melted and thawed, the snow is gone, and try to get that material out of your garden before the plants begin to reemerge this coming spring, because you want that old material oftentimes is a reservoir of disease-causing organisms, and you want it out of the way before the new plant tissue comes up out of the ground or before the trees leaf out.
Brian, you have a Facebook page. Talk about that page a little bit.
Yeah. In addition to my website, which I've mentioned, I also have a Facebook page. It's the UW Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. If you just look it up on Facebook, you'll be able to find it. You're welcome to follow me. I basically use it as a kind of a announcement platform. So when I have new fact sheets, when I do a weekly summary of diseases that I see in the clinic, when I post that information on my website, I put out an announcement about that. During the summer, lots of times, if I have cool samples, I'll take photos and put up photos with a little bit of a description. I also have Twitter, and I use it kind of for a very similar sort of purpose, basically to let you know about new things that are going on my website, or to post some photos with a little bit of limited information on diseases. And that's at UWPDDC. And one of the things that you can watch for, and I've got to get this done between now and next Wednesday, is I've been trying to do a monthly article on my website. And again, I would announce when that's available on Facebook and on Twitter. I enjoyed doing the one on December was how plant diseases contribute to the holiday season. My one for November was how plant diseases could potentially negative impact your Thanksgiving meal, which was a lot of fun. And I think this time I'm just going to kind of do a promotional write-up on our fact sheet series, because it's been a while since I've kind of told people about those and, you know, all the wonderful fact sheets that we have.
Well, now you're going to have to talk about that, the one you did in December.
That was lots of fun, because I talked a little bit about there's a particular disease-causing organism that causes actually the disease I studied when I did my PhD work. It's called bacterial brown spot. It also causes bacterial blight on lilacs. But that one, interestingly, has a little protein in one of its membranes that mimics an ice crystal. And so if you have high populations of that particular pathogen on leaves, and oftentimes it just hangs around without causing disease, if you have high enough populations and our temperatures dip down, it'll actually make plants freeze at a higher temperature than normal. So if you've got a plant without this organism, it'll oftentimes cool down to maybe about 28 degrees Fahrenheit before it'll freeze on its own. If you have high populations of this bacterium, it'll actually freeze at a higher temperature. And this phenomenon was just kind of discovered here at the UW-Madison. And the practical application of that is that they can use this protein to make artificial snow. So that's kind of cool. And then the other thing I talk about is, if you like poinsettias, the commercial poinsettias are infected with a pathogen called the phytoplasma. If you go to where poinsettias are native, they're tree-sized.
Yeah.
Of course, ours are small and compact and pretty bushy. And the one of the things that this phytoplasma organism does is, and it's very true of phytoplasmas in general when they get in plants, they tend to stunt the plants, and they tend to cause them to broom, so make more branches. And so that's a characteristic that we like in our poinsettias. And then I think the other thing I talked about was the fact that mistletoe is actually a plant parasite as well. So it's a plant that grows and invades other plants. So again, all of these plant pathology sort of things for the holiday seasons.
That's great. Let's go to Susan in La Crosse. Those are nice little nuggets of info there. Susan, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm very interested in the recent conversation about mulching trees.
Okay.
I mulched a large old maple tree, and this is a tree that happens to be in southwestern Minnesota. I can't tell you, so I hope it's okay to ask about that, but it's definitely relevant.
Sure.
After I mulched the tree and watered it quite a bit because it's a pretty dry climate out there, I noticed that on the bark and some of the branches, white appearing.
Okay.
And I realized that I probably had introduced some kind of fungus or some other organism to this beautiful tree.
Yeah, now the white that you're seeing, is it on dead branches?
No.
Okay, it's on live branches, and it's kind of...
On the trunk as well as some of the branches.
And is it little patches?
More streaky,
okay.
But patches could be a description.
Yeah, I'm going two different ways. One, I don't think you introduced anything in the mulch that you brought in for what you're talking about and describing here.
Okay.
It's not typical symptoms of what I was talking about before. With verticillium, you get branch dieback, and it's sectional branch dieback. You'll have a section of the tree that dies back, and then that'll kind of spread until the entire tree dies.
Okay.
Now, two things that it could be with the white blotchy that you're talking about or the streaky, it could be what are called lichens. These are kind of a combination of a fungus and a yeast and an alga. And they grow, and they like to grow on surfaces. And lots of times you'll see them on branches and trunks. They are not disease-causing organisms, and they're not really causing any issue. They just like to grow on things. Now, if you've had any wounding in the tree, so maybe some cold injury, or you've had some stress in the tree, so the tree is a little bit weakened, there are certain types of fungi that can come in. And there's one called the milky white tooth polypore, and it will form kind of a crusty sort of growth on the branches, but that's usually on branches that are in decline, and it will cause additional branch dieback once it gets in. It's very opportunistic, though, and you could prune that out.
I would say this is healthy tissue that is on.
Yep.
So it sounds more like the lichen.
Yeah. If you'd like to read up more.
My mind at ease a little bit.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Well, you put my mind at ease.
Oh, good. Oh. Are you hooked up to the internet by any chance?
Sure.
Yeah, we have a fact sheet on lichens if you go to my website and look in the fact sheet section. The other thing, if you have a digital camera and want to take some photos, you're welcome to send those to me. And again, if you go to my website, pddc.wisc.edu, there is a email where you can email me. And it may not be the one that I gave over the air earlier. I have like five different emails. They all go in the same email box, so you can use any of them to get a hold of me.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Still a little time for you to call in, too, at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Brian, why were you in New Zealand? Was it just a vacation?
I was vacationing, yeah. But I have to say, I'm always a plant pathologist even when I'm on vacation. The first thing I saw getting off the plane, we flew into Auckland, and the first thing I saw getting off the plane was a big poster as we went towards immigration that was like, beware of brown marmorated stink bug, which has not arrived in New Zealand yet. So that was kind of fun. And then we did some hiking on an island just off the coast of Auckland. It's called Wahiki Island. And we went in to take a hike, and as you went into this natural area, there was this big sign in a little station with spritz bottles of disinfectant. They have a particular species of phytophthora. We have phytophthora here that cause disease, but a specific species that is causing disease on native trees in this wildlife area. So we had to spritz our shoes as we went in and spritz them as we left. So that was quite interesting as well. So, you know, everywhere I go, there are plant diseases everywhere. And I went to the botanical garden in Christchurch and went into one of their greenhouses, and there was somebody setting up a display, and I noticed they had a lot of impatience, and I made the mistake of asking this person whether or not they had problems with downy mildew on impatiens, which is a real problem here. And all of a sudden, this worker took me over to talk to her supervisor, and then they finally took me to their head greenhouse grower, and I spent time getting a little back tour of their greenhouses. They were very, very friendly and just wonderful to me, and we talked about disease problems that they saw in their greenhouses and in some of their plants, and it was just a wonderful experience.
Oh, I that had to have been a great experience. I would love to visit there myself someday, New Zealand and Eastern Australia.
Yeah, we were in Eastern Australia along the coast.
Well, here we are. We got a couple minutes left before we're done. As we think about this coming spring, is there anything people can do now to be prepared for plant diseases that may occur during spring and summer?
What I would suggest, and I've written one of my articles that I wrote on my website last year, probably around March, was as you're starting to think about your vegetable garden, it's time to think about rotation and keep a plan of where you're growing your particular vegetables and make sure that you move those plants around from area to area in your garden, because you can avoid certain types of diseases if you don't grow the same plant in the same space all the time. And it's really easy to keep just a little map of where you have your radishes and your cabbage and your tomatoes, and just make sure you move things from plot to plot, different areas in your garden. And we have a great fact sheet again on that. It's using rotation in a home vegetable garden. Again, you can get that on my website. And it talks about certain plants are related enough to one another, like tomatoes and peppers and potatoes are related. So you need to be a little bit more careful about how you rotate those.
How you rotate those. And for a lot of people, with a small garden, it is difficult to rotate. But I guess even if you move...
I say if you can move it 6 inches, you're better off than not moving it at all. So it's one of those situations. And my dad is a perfect example where he's got a very small, compact garden in his back yard. And over the years, he has rotated stuff and has had relatively few disease problems, given that he's been gardening in that area for, 40 years or more.
And even though he doesn't have a lot of... He might only be moving something a foot.
Yeah, a very small area. He's not moving it really that far, and he tends to pack a lot of stuff in a small area, but he's amazingly has a very good success with growing vegetables with very little chemical input, quite frankly. He does a lot through rotation and amending soil and that sort of thing.
Is there anything new on the organic side or the chemical side in terms of treating diseases that are common to us?
Sometimes there are new chemistries that come out, but we're still dealing oftentimes with the same sort of chemistries that we have in the past. The real big push nowadays is to become familiar with what are called frac codes. And you can actually look this up on the internet, type in frac code. Right now, you probably have to type in 2017. Probably about a month from now, you can type in 2018. They update the information about once a year. And they list all of the active ingredients in fungicide products and classify them, group them by their mode of action, and give them a code. Anything that has a similar mode of action gets a code. And anytime you're using fungicides, you want to typically alternate products that have different frac codes. And because if you use the same active ingredient with the same mode of action over and over again, you can select for variants of pathogens that will no longer be controlled by that active ingredient. And the same thing applies for insecticides. There's a similar list for the active ingredients in insecticides as
Very
well.
Very cool. Someone wanted you to spell out the website address and so forth a little more slowly.
My apologies. I tend to talk fast. You can always look up UW Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic if you want to do that. But it's P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, dot... WISC, short for Wisconsin, .edu, short for education.
There we go. And your Twitter, your Facebook?
My Twitter handle is at UWPDDC, and Facebook, again, you can look up UW Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic.
Brian, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And you and I will be together with Lisa Johnson in a couple of weeks for Garden Expo.
Yeah, and come and visit me at my booth. I enjoy having people come by and answering questions and just chatting with folks.
Brian Huddleston is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. Always great to have him along. And he'll be back, but come visit us at Garden Expo. And Monday, we'll learn about the role of energy and energy jobs in Wisconsin's economy. For now, stay with us.